Times Square. Monthly support gives KPFK stability we can count on, not just during drives, but all year long. We're hoping that you can help us reach 500 sustaining members by December 31st by calling 818-985-5735 and pressing option 2. Or you can donate to become a monthly sustainer online at kpfk.org/donate. Happy holidays to everyone, and here's to more power to the people and people-powered radio in 2026.
Hello, and you're listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles and KPFT Houston, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I'm Jack Eit. On today's show, Simon Bolivar, the Monroe Doctrine, and U.S. intervention in Latin America. Historian Greg Grandin and journalist Michael Fox examine the long shadow of the Monroe Doctrine, which continues to shape U.S. imperialism in Latin America today. Greg Grandin is the author of Fordlandia, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. A professor of history at Yale University, Grandin has published a number of other award-winning books, including Empire's Workshop, The Last Colonial Massacre, and The Blood of Guatemala. We start with a clip on the history and accomplishments of Venezuelan statesman and military officer Simon Bolivar, who led six Latin American countries to their independence from Spain and today is known as El Liberador, from NBC News.
Bogota, Colombia. Cairo, Egypt. New York, New York. Three different cities on three separate continents. Yet all three pay homage to Simon Bolivar, a military and political leader who helped Latin America gain its independence from Spain in the early 19th century. In 1783, Simon Bolivar was born in Caracas, Venezuela, a colony of Spain. He belonged to a social class known as Creoles, wealthy Latin Americans of European descent, who owned ranches, mines, and businesses in South America. Bolivar's family owned several gold and copper mines. After the death of his parents, Bolivar moved to Spain and completed his formal education in Europe. It was there that he was first exposed to the Enlightenment ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity, and the concept of representative government that had been forged in the wake of the American and French revolutions. Bolivar longed to liberate his people from Spanish control and bring a representative government to Venezuela. He also sought to abolish slavery, calling it the Daughter of Darkness. In 1808, after Napoleon Bonaparte named his brother Joseph the King of Spain and all of its colonies, Bolivar joined the fight for Venezuelan independence. The First Republic of Venezuela was established after an uprising in 1810, but it was toppled by Spanish forces in 1812. Bolivar restored the Venezuelan Republic in 1813 after several military engagements known as the Admirable Campaign. During the campaign, Bolivar, in a bold maneuver, led his troops over the Andes Mountains to surprise Spanish forces in Bogotá. After a series of victories, his people proclaimed him El Libertador, or the Liberator. Bolivar continued to sweep through Latin America, securing an essential alliance with the Argentinian general José de San Martín. Together, they liberated Peru. In 1825, the Congress of Upper Peru created the Republic of Bolivia to honor Bolívar. In a speech called the Angostura Address, Bolívar said, "The most perfect system of government is that which results in the greatest possible measure of happiness and the maximum of social security and political stability." Bolívar helped create Gran Colombia, a federation that is now the countries of Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, and Ecuador. Although the federation would ultimately fail, Bolívar acknowledged his people's successful fight for independence, telling them, "Those who served the revolution have plowed the sea." The countries that had formed Gran Colombia went on to govern themselves independently. Simón Bolívar died in 1830. To this day, he stands as a source of inspiration in Latin America and throughout the world for his dedication to the Enlightenment ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity.
The Chilean folk music group Inti Illimani doing the song Simón Bolívar from 1973. In this show, journalist Michael Fox dives into the past and present with Yale historian Greg Grandin. The interview comes from Fox's excellent podcast series called Under the Shadow. The podcast is produced in partnership between the Real News Network and NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America.
Today, I'm going to travel back to that time and then walk up to the present with historian Greg Grandin.
Well, my name is Greg Grandin, and I teach history at Yale University, and I'm the author of a number of books, the most recent one being The End of the Myth.
Greg is also the former executive editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, which co-produces this podcast, and he's really prolific. He's the author of numerous books focusing on U.S. intervention in Latin America, The Last Colonial Massacre, Empire's Workshop, The Blood of Guatemala, Kissinger's Shadow. I recorded this interview with him late last year when I was just drafting the first few episodes of this podcast series and before I visited the Bolivar Monument in Panama City. We'll be diving into Simón Bolívar's Panama Congress, but also Monroe and the legacy of U.S. imperialism in the region until today. Here it is. So like I was mentioning, I want to start with kind of the big picture, go all the way back. You know, obviously I'm talking about U.S. intervention. If you could talk about Monroe Doctrine, how it was created, why, and how it laid the foundation for centuries of what we've seen until then, you know, U.S. intervention and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, other countries have statements. We have doctrines, you know, that's the thing. And it wasn't really a doctrine. It was the 200th anniversary just a few days ago of the Monroe Doctrine, meaning President James Monroe in the State of the Union Address, which he delivers a transcript to Congress at the time. He didn't actually give the address. Talked about the United States' relationship with soon-to-be independent countries within the Western Hemisphere. This was a time when 1823 was a moment in which it became clear that Spain had lost the Americas, except for Cuba and Puerto Rico. But Bolivar had won his wars, San Martin in Chile and Peru had won his wars, Argentina, Mexico were all going to be free. And the United States had spent a long time, well, the United States political elite, you know, people who ran its foreign policy at the time, James Monroe, it was kind of 1823. So we're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 decades after independence. So it's really talking about the either the younger founders or second generation political leaders of the United States. John Quincy Adams, John Calhoun, James Monroe, Henry Clay, senator from Tennessee, from Kentucky, that was very influential in foreign policy. And they were trying to figure out what to do and say about what would soon be a free Spanish America and what the United States' opinion was. There was a lot of things to consider, and mostly they were looking at that question vis-a-vis Europe, their alliance with Great Britain, their rivalry with the Holy Roman Empire and Russia, their fear of France and fear of an attempt to reconquer the Americas for the Bourbon crown. So there was a lot of things at stake. And the United States basically kept silent as these wars went on. I mean, the Spanish-American Wars for Independence weren't like the United States. They weren't like a few years of fighting and a handful of famous battles. It went on for decades. They started basically in 1810, and they went on to 1823, and they took place across the entire expanse of South America, Central America, and Mexico, and the Caribbean. And these were bloody, destructive wars. And the United States watched it all, and held its counsel. They didn't know what to do. On the one hand, they wanted Spain out of the Americas. On the other hand, they didn't want these new nations to either form a single nation among themselves, and that wasn't very likely considering the geography, considering the political differences between. And so they issued no grand pronouncements until Monroe did at the end of December 2nd, 1823. In a statement that was mostly written by his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. The idea at first was to make a joint announcement with Great Britain to claim that no part of the Americas are open to reconquest. But Adams thought it was better if the United States just did it unilaterally. And it's a very ambiguous statement. And in many ways, the power of what becomes known as the Monroe Doctrine lies in that ambiguity. It could reconcile different positions. So, you know, just to break it down in its simplest components, you had people like Henry Clay, who imagined creating what he called an American system that included Latin America, a large manufacturing and agricultural customs union, perhaps. But, you know, the United States as the kind of core to the Latin American periphery. You might call that an early version of internationalism. John Quincy Adams was, I don't want to say he was an isolationist, but he was much more of a unilateralist. And he has a famous quote, "There is an American system and it's called the United States." Now, basically, we didn't need Latin America. So what the Monroe Doctrine does is it allows for a reconciliation of all of these different positions in its ambiguity. And it was very vague on what the intentions were. I mean, you know, basically summed up, it said that, quote unquote, the free and independent nations of the two American continents were off limits for future colonization by any European power. And Monroe let it be known that any effort to, quote, unquote, extend Europe's system to any portion of the hemisphere would be viewed as the United States as a threat. That's like the core of what we think of as the Monroe Doctrine. Monroe said that Europe is essentially different from the United States, but he doesn't define what that difference is. He talks about two different systems, and it's implied that the two different systems are republicanism and imperial monarchism, but doesn't quite come out and say that. He just talks about different systems. And the United States would, despite making this very broad claim, continue to recognize Europe's possessions of areas of the New World that weren't being contested. such as British Guyana or Canada, Jamaica, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, where there were no strong independence movements at the time. What's interesting about the Monroe Doctrine is that we think of it now as this doctrine of mandatory power, where the United States is assigning to itself the role to police Latin America, as it had become, right? There's the Theodore Roosevelt's famous corollary, where it assumes the United States has the right to impose its will on reckless or irresponsible nations. But at the time, the Monroe Doctrine was celebrated by independence leaders. One, they were happy that the United States seemed to finally come out for Latin or Spanish American independence. That was a huge thing. I mean, there was still a couple of big battles left before Spain finally gave up completely. But the more important thing is that they read in the Monroe Doctrine a corollary to their own anti-colonialism. They didn't read it as a doctrine of neocolonialism. They read it as a doctrine as anti-colonialism, that, you know, no part of the Americas is eligible for reconquest. They saw it as analogous to their own anti-colonialism. So there was a lot of celebratory messages to Monroe from Latin American leaders, thanking him for the doctrine, you know, not the doctrine, but for the pronouncement. And then it wasn't until later on that we could talk about how it evolved into what it became. But at first it was celebrated by Spanish America's independence leaders.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps. Visit our website, Eco Justice Radio, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you're listening to Simon Bolivar, The Monroe Doctrine and U.S. Intervention in Latin America. I'm your host, Jack Eid, and we share clips from a podcast series called Under the Shadow. Historian Greg Grandin and journalist Michael Fox examine the long shadow of the Monroe Doctrine, which continues to shape U.S. imperialism in Central and South America. But first, the Nicaraguan poet Rubén Darío, who died in 1916. The America of Moctezuma and Atahualpa. The aromatic America of Columbus. Catholic America, Spanish America. The America where noble Cuauhtémoc said, "I am not on a bed of roses." Our America trembling with hurricanes, trembling with love. O men with Saxon eyes and barbarous souls, our America lives and dreams and loves, and it is the daughter of the sun. Be careful. That was Rubén Darío, Nicaraguan poet.
Now, I want to kind of transition into kind of what it evolved to, why. And you mentioned the Roosevelt corollary that I think is really key, which kind of puts it into high gear. I guess the first question is, 200-year anniversary, what would you say its legacy is today?
Well, I would say the Monroe Doctrine is kind of the gateway legal principle that allows the United States to reconcile idealism and realism, or isolationism and internationalism, right? It's the, you know, there's something about the United States where all those concepts are very slippery, right? The Republicans are isolationists, except for Latin America. You know, Latin America is ours and we have to police it. That's kind of it's a slippery slope towards, once you say that, that's a slippery slope towards a more robust globalism. You know, so it's going back to its foundational vagueness and ambiguity. It allows the reconciliation of different political positions. It did it at its founding, and it continued to do so as it went on. Woodrow Wilson, for instance, just to give you an example, Woodrow Wilson was complicated, and I'm not carrying any water for Woodrow Wilson, but his relationship with Latin America, he did agree with Latin America that the heart of the Monroe Doctrine was a kind of anti-colonialism, and that spirit of the Monroe Doctrine should become the basis of the League of Nations, a world doctrine. When he kept on trying to sell the League of Nations, he kept on talking about the Monroe Doctrine in its expansive, generous sense, not as a police warrant, but as a kind of principle of anti-colonialism and national sovereignty. But the pushback that Wilson got from conservatives who didn't want to give up United States sovereignty, right, the people who eventually tanked the League of Nations and prevented the Senate from ratifying the League of Nations, they seized on the Monroe Doctrine. And they wanted to know if the League of Nations was going to override the Monroe Doctrine, you know, not allow the United States to act with mandatory power unilaterally wherever it need be. And Wilson completely caved on that question. He started out talking about the League of Nations. If you want to know what the League of Nations is, look at the Monroe Doctrine, look at Pan-Americanism, look what we've done in the Americas. We've created a continent of free, sovereign nations. That's what we want for the world. But in order to appease the nationalists and the chauvinists in Paris, he totally gave in. He gets a telegram from Senator Taft saying, you know, there's no way that this is going to pass unless there's some specific acknowledgement that the Monroe Doctrine is untouchable. And so Wilson has them insert in charter of the League of Nations that regional understandings such as the, especially the Monroe Doctrine, will not be affected. So it, you know, so you see exactly the kind of tension between the Monroe Doctrine as this anti-colonial principle and this Monroe Doctrine as this assertion of national chauvinism and informal empire clashing. And most of the time they reconcile these different positions. So going back to your question, what has been its major legacy? It's in some ways the gateway drug or the gateway legal principle through which the United States has been able to kind of reconcile its different competing impulses from isolationism on one end of the spectrum to international globalism on the other side of the spectrum. That happens in Latin America.
Greg, if you were going to try and explain to somebody who just had no clue about its impact then later, over the many years, or what it's become, Monroe Doctrine, and the excuses it's been, you know, used for invasions and things like that.
I just gave the more kind of Hegelian version of what the Monroe Doctrine is. But the fact of the matter is that when its power, when it's asserted, is, you know, it doesn't really become a doctrine. The phrase Monroe Doctrine or Doctrine of Monroe doesn't come into circulation until about the 1850s or 60s, when the United States is in competition with Great Britain to build a canal through Nicaragua. And so that's when the Monroe Doctrine gets asserted. And the United States doesn't have the power to enforce, you know, the hands-off the Americas principle of the Monroe Doctrine till much later. Then as time goes on, the Monroe Doctrine becomes more of a doctrine of, as I mentioned, informal empire, mandatory power. And this is explicit with Theodore Roosevelt and his corollary, which says, you know, the Monroe Doctrine basically gives the United States the right to police the hemisphere. Another Secretary of State, Olney, I think, said that the United States is, you know, sovereign across the hemisphere. And not sovereignty is found in the Monroe Doctrine. It does become associated with interventionism, with regime change, with United States' and meddling in Latin American affairs. And so then what you see later, when it's no longer acceptable to speak in the kind of language of Theodore Roosevelt, where you have to at least pay lip service to Latin American sovereignty. You know, if you Google the Monroe Doctrine is dead, or, you know, the Monroe Doctrine is over, you'll see, if you do an engram of it, you know, there's different moments, right? Like after the pink tide, you know, after Lula and Chavez were elected in the early 2000s, there were lots of essays about the end of the Monroe Doctrine. I think the Council of Hemispheric Affairs said the Monroe Doctrine is over. You know, so there's lots of declarations on the Monroe Doctrine being over. But now you listen to the Republicans and they're once again explicitly reasserting the Monroe Doctrine. So it's just this, it's a totem. It's a totem in U.S. politics.
You know, it was super interesting. The guy who, completely forgetting his name right now, but he was just voted out of the, he was the head of the House Republican because he wasn't strong enough.
Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. So he went and spoke. I found this clip online like a couple weeks ago at Oxford, and it was a debate over U.S. intervention. And so he starts off by saying, well, we all know that U.S. intervention is good. And that's like the beginning of the rest of the conversation.
The United States had no right.
So that was like the, right. Okay. I get it. Right. It's still a thing. This is still a, how is Manifest Destiny wrapped up into this?
Yeah. Manifest Destiny is, it's related in the sense that it's about United States expansion. And it was a phrase coined by John O'Sullivan. It was, one of these expansionists that was around during the time of the annexation of Texas and the Mexican-American War, when the United States was pushing hard west, to get to the Pacific. And there was a lot of different vectors of that propulsion west. There was the desire to kind of extend the country, to diffuse the slavery conflict, the idea that, there'd be free enslaved states admitted, one after the other. And, but that basically just delayed the ultimate coming of the Civil War. But there was this idea that expansion would somehow resolve the problem. There was the idea of expansion as a safety valve for workers, for the immigrants that were pouring in, that giving that free land would solve the problem of high rents and low wages in New York and in Boston. There was a clear sense that the West was valuable, that there was land and minerals and that it was basically collateral for United States expansion. United States could basically hold up, the prospect of taking the West as collateral on loans to capitalize its development. There was a lot of drivers of Western expansion. And John O'Sullivan was of a generation that was called Young America, that saw Western expansion as keeping the United States young. And in some ways, it was a perverse corollary of the war of the revolutions of 1848 in Europe, where the wars and the revolutions of 1848 in Europe offered they were all defeated and they were all put down, but at least they put the social question on the table, and they were the beginnings of labor parties and trade union. And there was this notion of a European spring, and they were going to overthrow the old monarchs, and there would be a young Europe. And the way that manifested in the United States was perversely not by fighting, not through class struggle against the oligarchs and the aristocrats upward, but fighting against Indians westward. So John O'Sullivan was an ardent expansionist. He was a proponent of the war, of going to war in Mexico to take Mexico to get to the Pacific. And he came up with the expression manifest destiny. That's the United States' manifest destiny to occupy the continent fully. And it's a very subjectivist, romantic, Hegelian sentiment, right? That that there's potential manifest within the thing itself, that, that will being and becoming, that what it, the United States is not yet, and it will be, and it will be when it fills out the continent. And that's the expression manifest destiny.
Under the Shadow is a co-production in partnership with The Real News and NACLA. The theme music is by my band Monte Perdido. This is Michael Fox. Many thanks.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Simon Bolivar, The Monroe Doctrine and U.S. Intervention in Latin America. Thank you to the podcast series Under the Shadow with Greg Grandin and host Michael Fox. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. Project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on KPFK, KPFT, all major podcast apps, and at EcoJusticeRadio.org. Executive producer and host, myself, Jack Eid, co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
The Bradcast. Experts have said that the case has little chance of success at the Supreme Court, much like the numerous other GOP election lawsuits that are pending in battleground states. But then again, those experts, they are just guessing. They are hoping.
With your host, Brad Friedman, and producer, Desi Doyen.
There's enough going on right now. There are enough